You go to a CaratLane store opening, you will never see a celebrity. We don't call film stars or politicians or, you know, other famous. We always call a loyal customer of the brand to come and do the store opening, to do the inauguration. Even people from the company, so people, a partner or somebody will, you know, call Mithun or me or Atul or anybody. We don't go and cut the ribbon. It's always cut by the customer, because we feel that the most important person who comes to the store is the customer. The CaratLane India business did around 2,065 crores of revenue. Mm-hmm. And this is not GMV.
This is
net revenue, money which comes into the bank, mm-hmm. right? Even during COVID, the first wave, when everything was shut and deliveries were not allowed, and we had stopped marketing completely, people would come to our website and were trying to place orders. So the need to buy jewelry is deep in this country, yeah. because of the cultural and other elements. I think the funny thing is that, you know, it's almost as if my wife and kids or other people, right, they're just waiting for me to finish the conversation, and they know that I'm not looking at the person but looking at her ears or the jewelry she's wearing, and they would just literally say that, you know, it's literally count that when will the question start and say, okay, by the way, have you heard about
Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley Podcast. I'm your host, Jibraj, and today I have with me a very interesting guest. Join me in welcoming the co-founder and CEO of India's largest jewelry brand, CaratLane. Join me in welcoming Avnish Anand. Thank you so much, Avnish, for joining me. Very excited to be hosting you.
Thank you, Jibraj. I'm equally excited to have this conversation with you. Just one small correction, we are not India's largest jewelry brand. I would say largest omni-channel jewelry brand.
Yeah, new age jewelry brand,
yeah.
If I may. But for all the right reasons, right? Because it's CaratLane in itself, in the startup ecosystem, has been such a mammoth success, because you've broken on the conventional sort of startup wisdom, right? Which is to say that you started at a time where jewelry was not like the thing, or e-commerce was not the thing, 2007, right? Like
there was no Amazon, Flipkart, nothing. Yeah, yeah. We
you
saw those people also start in front of our eyes at that point in time.
Exactly. So this was non-obvious. It was not a wave. E-commerce was not the thing. And so you've broken all of those things and still emerged. And also retail now, you've done omni-channel, things that have not been done before. So I think that's very fascinating. The story of you having joined CaratLane also and then having scaled it and what you're doing right now is also very fascinating. So I want to cover all of those aspects through the conversation. What might be a good starting point is, as I was trying to tell you before the conversation, right? How does an IIM Lucknow grad sort of join in 2007 as the first employee of an unproven model in something that was yet to be tested? And also that's something that took 1 year to sort of gestate and start operations, right? Talk to us about those early days. What were you thinking? I know you mentioned in the past that you wanted some startup exposure, retail exposure, but what was going on in your mind in that time? That'll be very interesting to hear.
So actually, you know, it all kind of built up. So first thing is that, you know, I come from a typical small town, middle class Indian family, where you were always told to get a good education and then get a job in a international MNC and your life will be set forever. So I kind of followed that path, and I ended up in a place where I thought it was now going to be set for life. But you know, in every organization where I worked, and I worked for two, I would say, MNCs, Standard Chartered Bank and DuPont, and no offense to these organizations, but I kind of never settled and I was not happy. So you could have, you know, I had this a little bit of a restlessness. I can't keep doing this forever, and it's not challenging me and it's not interesting or exciting. So that was one. Second, that there were two other things which were happening, that I had always been interested in retail businesses, and I had tried to get into it. But you know what happens is that once you get a experience behind you, then the filter which people, companies use, is that they would always ask you that you have the relevant retail experience, or you know, your resume would not get shortlisted even though you tried. So that wasn't happening. The third thing was that my wife and one of my college friends, close friend, they were both working in Bharat Matrimony. So I would see their work. You know, I would be free on a Saturday and they would go to office and they would, you know, do all this interesting work and say, we did this and consumers increase and we're building this business. Mm-hmm. So I obviously found that very interesting. And while the e-commerce space had not really taken off in India, but there were these other businesses, right? The early Rediff and India Times, plus all the classified businesses were there. So people were doing things, and we were hearing about startups and how these places were far more interesting, exciting places to be. Luckily for me, there were a couple of friends or people from college who had done this also.
Okay.
Including, there was one classmate of mine who built a gate training business, which he sold to, I forget the name, Educomp, I think. So there were those things, and you could see, you know, the way they would be. Where, yeah, you could see how their life was. So I had got some glimpses of how interesting or exciting it was for them. And, you know, it was almost as if, all my life I kind of tried for this, but it is not fulfilling or it's not satisfying.
Yeah.
And these are the other things which I want to do. And finally, I would say that I had a little bit of a risk-taking appetite, I would say.
Right.
And, you know, kind of not doing what was prescribed or the right thing. In that sense, you could say that I followed the path, so how can I say that I was doing different? But, you know, small things I had done in life. Mm-hmm. For example, everybody wanted me to get into engineering. I had gotten into decent engineering colleges, you know, but I went to ISI because I wanted to study maths and economics, for example, in spite of everybody saying that, why are you going into this direction? And a few other things as well. So that way, I had kind of taken, you know, my own decisions based on what I wanted. So you know, and luckily for me, I was very young at that age. So you have a little bit of a higher appetite for risk at that point in time. So, you know, all these things kind of came together. This desire to get into an internet business, a retail business, dissatisfaction, seeing that startups are kind of this interesting thing, having a little bit of a risk appetite, and suddenly this opportunity comes up. In fact, I was not going to go for the interview saying that these guys will again reject me, saying you don't have the relevant experience. But thanks to the headhunter who had called me to call me for the interview, Vinod, and I'm forever grateful to him that he insisted and he was very persistent that you should go. And luckily for me, it all worked out well. I don't know, it all have worked out well because I kind of liked Mithun and Gopal, and I thought, and the question I asked myself was that what was the worst thing which was going to happen?
Yeah.
And I also kind of thought that if it even goes on for 2 years, at least this 2 year experience will change my resume so that in future, at least consumer internet and retail companies might look at me at least. So agar kuch bhi nahi hua, you know, nobody thought it was going to become this big company and itna valuation or whatever. I just thought that I'll learn a lot of things. My resume will change. I'll get a new experience under my belt and life will change at least from that point of view. You know, at that point, I had also considered that should I go and do a second MBA. A lot of people used to go to the US and do a second MBA. So this was a much better option in that sense as compared to doing all of that. So.
And 16 years later, here we are.
Here we are.
No, that's super interesting. I think just to know the, I think there's a lot of maturity and risk taking appetite that we have to, you know, underwrite. It's very common now to join startups.
It's changed early. So much, yeah, yeah.
Yes. What's the change according to you, right? Now that you hire folks on a reasonably scaled up company, but you also look at early stage founders, you look at peer folks also starting up. What is the dynamic that you've seen in terms of just delta that the startup ecosystem has caused?
See, I'll tell you, at that time when I was joining, we didn't even have an ESOP or an equity conversation at the time of joining. Yeah. So that was the level of ignorance and not knowing about things, right? They were also going to hire, you know, build a team of 4 people as core to building the business. People like me, right? Good pedigree, that was Gopal's requirement. And good pedigree was good companies and good education, essentially. They were not able to get the other 3 people. And I used to keep waiting that baki log bhi aayenge, but nobody came. So it was the lack of ignorance about startups, right? And the ecosystem was very, very early.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have Shopify or Magento. There were no logistics companies. There was no success story as such. So in that sense, it was like very, very early days of life, right, in that sense. And it was very uncool to join a startup at that point in time, right? People would still ask me, why have you joined this? In fact, at that point in time, I would do a lot of sports blogging. And many people in my class would think that was my main job. And I was doing this Carrot Lane startup thingy on the side. So, no, it was that early. And I think over a period of time, as more success has happened, right? There are so many success stories that now people see it as a great career option. And the risk has come down a lot, right? because you know what questions to ask, what homework to do, what kind of companies will do well. You know, this terminology of Series A, Series B, yes, nobody knew also back then. In fact, when I was trying to do a little bit of due diligence, I didn't even know what questions to ask them, honestly. There were only a couple of friends, this guy in the Bharat Matrimony and another friend who worked in Naukri.com. These are the only two people I asked, and they also really couldn't come up with a lot of questions. So, you know, in fact, you know, ignorance was also a reason to join CaratLine, I would say, because I didn't know about the risks. Had I known a lot about jewelry, or had I known a lot about the consumer intermittence, I would have possibly, you know, weighed down the risks. But not knowing anything helped. And today people know everything. You know, like I have a 13-year-old daughter. She knows about startups, right? She knows about funding, and she knows about which companies are there. So it's like gone to the other extreme end. Like, it's like this country is fully informed out now. Yeah. The ecosystem is much different. And it's an equally good choice, right? Yeah. As compared to, you know, whether you are sitting for placements or whether you are considering career choices.
Yeah. I can imagine. And I was reading on, you know, the blogging bit that you mentioned, and on my way I was thinking you're the real content creator, right, of the times, because at the time you would imagine creating content.
You know, we would have Blogspot and WordPress. Abhi toh, I don't think anybody does that. People write on Medium and Substack.
Just publish yourself all of this as well. But it's come a long, long way, and really glad to just observe all of those learnings. Another thing that really struck me is that, you know, CaratLine now stands for this affordable jewelry, but with a sleek design. It's made for everyone, and it's still premium, right? Was this the same thesis that you began with? Did the vision change along the way? Because, of course, form factor has changed multifold. You had a B2B business at one point as well. But what I'd be really, it'll be great to know is, what was the initial thesis and how has that sort of moved, or has it all been strategized and, you know, execute under that mission so that you can achieve it?
So I'll tell you, the original thesis came from three things. Mithun comes from a jewelry family, right? They've been in the jewelry making business for generations, and they operate at the very premium end of the business, you know, very high end.
Right.
They have a store in Hughes Road in Bombay. So you can just, the address can tell you, you know, what kind of business they run. So he had seen a couple of things about the inefficiencies or the issues in the business model. One was that, you know, everybody was only operating at the higher end, only catering to the, you know, the super rich in that sense, or the rich, almost like the way the airlines were disrupted, right? Earlier, nobody would travel. So the same thing was happening in the jewelry business, that all the design work, all the jewelry making would only happen for the big occasions like weddings. Of a people who are really, you know, really well off or very rich. So that was one. But there was nobody who was making jewelry, beautiful jewelry, at the lower price points, you know, sub 20, sub 40,000. So that was one. Second, the business model itself was broken. So he could see that, you know, people would just build a lot of inventory, build these mega stores. The way they would scale the business, all of that was very, very archaic. Nothing had changed for the longest time. There was no progress happening in the business model as such. The third thing was that because he was in the US, he was studying over there, that he saw the early signs of how technology and internet was changing the business model. So he saw Blue Nile very close because he worked in the diamond business in America. So he kind of, these three things were the, in a way, the three points which led to his thesis of saying that using technology and the internet and building a, you know, lean business, you know, not this heavy inventory-led business, and creating designs at the lower price points was the way to go. However, we were initially focused on starting with solitaires because solitaires was what was working well in America also, and we thought that the same could be replicated over here because it's, you know, solitaires are fairly commoditized, so easier to sell on the internet that way. But we did a consumer research a few months before we launched, and we realized that this country was almost not ready for it. The awareness and the need for solitaires was very low. And that's when we said, okay, let's then bring in the jewelry element as well. And we were very clear that what kind of jewelry we wanted to make, and Mithun knew that. You know, and because he was a person who was deeply involved in the technique and the manufacturing of jewelry, so he could really figure out that what kind of technique, manufacturing and design could create beautiful, affordable designs at lower price points. So that's how we got to it. So there was a minor change in the type of product we wanted to sell, but other than that, I think more or less we have continued with the thesis. Obviously, we have learned a lot and evolved based on that, But largely, this was the proposition from the beginning, that use technology, use the internet, make a leaner business, serve this kind of a mass audience in that sense.
Got it. I mean, that's interesting because, you know, it just stands for this amazing proposition now that everybody loves, and it's built its own sort of distinctive value add. But I was curious to understand if it was the same at the start. Why don't we also take a step back? And this is something that Mithun mentioned in one of his interviews, that Amish would always ask me,
what business are we in?
How do you think, you know, run, like, why do Indians buy jewelry, or why do people buy jewelry, right? And what is your answer to that?
Actually, the question was, which I would ask him, that what business are we in? And he would always say that it's such a stupid question which you ask me. Because, you know, we make jewelry, we are in the business of selling jewelry. But the reason I was asking him this question was that, you know, it was important for me to understand that what are the reasons why people buy jewelry, what occasions they buy jewelry, and, you know, when do they wear what kind of jewelry. And a lot of this question was coming from, you know, having read the JTBT framework, you know, this Clayton Christensen's book, Competing Against Luck, where he's asked this question, right, that there are these functional needs, and there are these other jobs for which people hire products, right, for making emotional or social progress in their life. So for me, having read that and, you know, really being fascinated by that framework, I would try and see that, you know, in our business, if I applied that framework, what was it? And, you know, Mithun being such a jewelry person, right, so such a, you know, I would say a design, jewelry design nerd almost, right, that he would not see beyond that and say, why are we even asking this question? Because we know what we're doing, right? People want to buy beautiful jewelry and we are giving them that. But over a time, over a period of time, and I made him read the book and I shared enough examples with him, and I was very persistent with this, that he finally saw the need to think like this. And there was a lot of data which made him see this. And one of the data points which really changed his mind was that, you know, we had got some 1 lakh, or for some period of time, we had got these 90,000 orders which were for gifting. The customers had clearly indicated that we are buying to gift to somebody. And we knew that a gifting share was always very high. Out of that, we saw that 80,000 people had used the option to put in a gift card. So that was like the eureka or the epiphany for him, that people, you know, the message matters so much. You know, you're buying a 20, 30, 40, 50,000 piece of jewelry for giving it to someone, and that is not enough. No, even with that amount of money, so you need to add more meaning and to that gift through the message. And you know, these are not the standard messages. People write their own long messages. So that told him that, you know, it is such an important thing to put that meaning, you know, and that emotion which you want to show to that person, right? That how much I love you or how much I care for you, which means that it is that emotion which they are seeking, you know, the meaning which they want to add, right? The thoughtfulness which they want to add. And that was the change which happened in the way we started thinking about things.
Yeah, no, that was really interesting, because sometimes you don't question these obvious things, but it's so fundamental to building a business to understand, like, you know, the experience, the gifting, the emotion, what it associates and how people associate value to it. Going a layer deeper, right, considering that you have access to all of this data and understanding, and you've seen the customer evolve as well, if I had to ask you how Indians buy jewelry, right, and if you had to give us a breakup of, like, where we stand, like, you know, it's seasonal, what kind of jewelry, who buys, can you give us a very quick overview of what that looks like?
See, in terms of the data, there is only so much data available at a macro level, right? Sure. We know that this is the size of the industry is crazy, right? Yeah. It's like some 2-4 lakh crores or whatever. Yeah. Largely, it is plain gold jewelry. Because this is a category where, you know, the value is very important. Yeah. Everybody in this country gets up and, you know, they know the gold rate for the day, right? Yeah. Everybody knows the making charge. And whenever people are buying, while they are buying it for adornment, people also see it as a very important investment thing, right? And not just investment in terms of the way you buy stocks, but also as a last, you know, the safety thing if everything goes bad, right? Mithun always quotes this as Chanakya said that you should always have gold because that is your protection against the government as well, right? You will always have that. So those are very, very core cultural, I would say, ethos or mores of this category. Other than that, you know, if you think about this country, And this is across, you know, caste, religion, community, states, whatever, that there are 1,000 reasons and celebrations in this country for which jewelry is like the default thing to be given. And you know, while obviously the weddings are the single biggest reason why people buy jewelry, but there are so many other reasons, you know, when a mother gives birth, right? And I'm sure that, you know, all of us can say that across groups, right? Everybody gives jewelry to the mom, to the child, right? And it's not like a religion or a caste or anything, right? It's common. This is an Indian thing, right? So I think the one unique thing about this category is, some of the unique things about this category are things like this, that it's, there is a value element, right? An investment angle. I don't think that's true for any other category. The second, which is very important thing, is that this whole deep embedding of jewelry into our culture, right? Like all these rites of passage in our life, right? That it's always going to be there. You know, it's like, it's so tightly integrated into culture in that sense, right? The third thing is that, you know, it's also a very unique category of how people build trust, right? Yeah. It's always ki teen generation say we are buying from this person. Correct. So the way it retails also is very interesting, right? So those, and you know, this is very only true about India. Like this category sells as an MRP product in America. Mm-hmm. But in India, if you are making the same product, and one time it gets made in 2.4 grams and one time in 2.5 grams, the price of the same SKU will be different. I don't think that's true for any category, right? When you buy a t-shirt, you don't say ki ek bar ye 1 meter mein bana, ek bar 1.1, so the price will be different, right? Or for any other category, right? Or a car or anything. So those are very, very unique things about this category. And but the good thing is that it's also like almost like a recession-proof category. Okay. Even during COVID, the first wave, when everything was shut and deliveries were not allowed, and we had stopped marketing completely, people would come to our website and were trying to place orders. So the need to buy jewelry is deep in this country because of the cultural and other elements. And it's very unique because of the value and the value all apart, basically. And I think one other thing which is happening is that earlier people would buy largely for weddings or other and a different kind of jewelry, and largely it would be put in the locker, right? The whole need for lockers, I think, in this country has come from storing jewelry, right? Like lockers are the place for people jewelry. So we, in fact, have this tagline where we would say that, you know, jewelry which should not be put in your lockers, right? And the big change which has happened is that now people buy jewelry like fashion, right? They want to pair it with the clothes they wear every day, whether it is for a party or at work or just for a casual evening out. That is a big change, and it's not just young people who are doing it. Even older people, you know, even 60, 70 year olds now to want to wear jewelry. So earlier people were buying jewelry which was like, you know, while it was jewelry, but it was the investment and the keeping it for a rainy day was an important consideration. I think now people want to buy jewelry because they want to wear it.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's one big change which has happened, but both things are still happening in this country.
Yeah. Well, those are super interesting observations. I think a lot of interesting learnings there. I'd be curious to understand, is there anything that you strongly believed in that the customer will behave this way? This radically surprised you? Like, is there anything objectively which you all got absolutely wrong through the journey?
See, one of the things we would think is that there is an internet savvy customer. That our customer would be an internet savvy customer because we are selling on the internet. Right. Even after we have opened stores, we saw that because most of our marketing was done digitally and online, that we were addressing an internet savvy customer, and we were completely wrong about it. That people figure out a way to use the internet either through their moms or either through their children or otherwise. But our customer is, you know, we have customers across age groups and across the length and breadth of this country. Because everybody wants to wear this kind of jewelry. So in terms of putting an age or a demographic or a psychographic filter in that sense, I don't think that is right. In fact, we noticed one thing very interesting. You know, every time young women, people from agencies and Google and Facebook would come, we would always ask them that, how do you buy your jewelry? And I would hear one thing every time. So, you know, actually before we learned this, we would not target people who were, say, above 50 years of age, saying our audience is women, you know, urban and this age group. Yeah. And every time we would talk to them and we would say, how did you buy your jewelry? And they would always say, my grandmother or my mother told me that you should go buy this, or this is a good brand, or this is a good design. And then I would ask them, how did they discover our brand? They would say, oh, you know, they have a smartphone, they have enough time to kill. So they were looking at Facebook feed and they saw this, or they were looking at your website. Then we realized that these are all micro influencers at home, you know, or home influencers, because they actually have more time and more know-how and possibly even more interest in the category, and they are influencing their daughters and their nieces and their daughter-in-laws to kind of, they were telling them about Carrot Lane, imagine, and they were buying. And these are also people, and you know, the MD of Titan says this best. He calls these older people the platinum class, because they are done with all their commitments, they have no liabilities, and they have a lot of money, and they have a lot of reason to give gifts to people. So therefore, going after them is a very interesting thing. And this is, see, obviously we started with the big mistake of saying that, you know, let's do solitaires. So which we got wrong. Luckily, we had that customer research. And over a period of time, we have been proven wrong about many things. The first store which we started, we again copied Blue Nile. Blue Nile had these stores called web rooms. Just meant there was no real jewelry, or, you know, you could not buy jewelry. So we opened this first high experience center. So we opened the store in GK, lot of fancy screens and all of that, right? No jewelry. And it was a big disaster.
Yeah.
So that way is what has, I think we have tried enough things, and I think if somebody wrote the history of this company, there are enough disasters which have happened along the way, enough failures in that sense. You know, the period when we first got money, uske pehle for 4 years we had no money, so we were very frugal, right? Then we got money. So when you get money, you try more things, right? So we did a lot of the typical TV and all of those things. Then we made enough mistakes over there as well. And it's not that even later. So that way is, I think we have been going wrong.
Enough mistakes, but I was just trying to understand.
So these are some of the ones which I...
Very counterintuitive learnings. Ki ye socha tha, but ye ho gaya. So that really stands out. But very, very fascinating. I want to go deeper into, you know, how the scale of Carrot Lane has been achieved, right? Because I think that's very unique in itself. The playbook to scale a brand successfully, also omni-channel, grow on all sides, customer awareness, orders, and then revenue, of course, is very unique. But before we get there, I'd love to understand if you can just shed light on the context of how big Carrot Lane today is, right? Around about 200 stores?
245.
And, you know, what is that scale? How many customers? And, like, when is the cyclical periods? If you can just give us that overview, then we can go deeper into the business aspects of how you got here in itself. So, very quick overview.
See, last year, the Carrot Lane India business did around 2,065 crores of revenue. Mm-hmm. And this is not GMV.
This is net revenue,
money which comes into the bank, right? See, again, we never used the term GMV because we didn't know that there was a term like this. So, and last year we opened 85 stores because now we feel that the brand is very strong. We have got other processes in place in terms of hiring, training, marketing, merchandising, etc. So, which is why last year was the year where we really scaled up, right? Went from almost 1,250 crores to 2,065 last year. Opened 85 stores across the length and breadth of this country. And now we are going, you know, the other question which a lot of people ask is that this kind of contemporary design, will it work in small town India, with the heart and hinterland of this country? So we have now opened stores in places like Vapi, Tirunelveli, Kangra, Muzaffarpur, and all of these are doing well, which kind of, you know, which is the other counterintuitive thing, right? Which people kind of start to put people in buckets, right? Ki ye log modern design chahiye, inko nahi chahiye, right? And now we are very clear that we have kind of, we feel that we have got the playbook sorted and also the execution engine to execute that playbook effectively, right? Mm-hmm. We know our problems. We know what direction we want to go into. So now the only thing is to keep building and to keep scaling it up. There are obviously changes which have to be made, which are underway in a lot of our people processes, because people, it's a very people intensive business. It's not a tech, cool tech business in that sense that use technology to scale. So that way we are very clear. So people and other changes are happening, you know, manufacturing, opening of stores, all of that scaling up is happening. So that's in a way the extent of the size. And we are very clear because we have already identified enough locations that we will keep opening stores. And the goal has not changed. You know, the last 5 years we have had a 50 plus CAGR growth. And we see no reason because of, you know, the who we think we are targeting and for what reasons we are targeting them and why people will buy our jewelry. We feel that there is no reason why this business cannot keep growing at 50% CAGR even at this pace for the next 5 years. We have to just make sure that we put all the pieces in place to make that happen, and which is what we are doing. So the next milestone in that sense for us is to get to 10,000 crores. And you know, there's a lot of competition which is coming, and everybody wants to copy the Caratlyn model. But there is so much demand for this category in this country, and there's so many, you know, the young and the old and the urban and the rural both buy, right? So that way there is enough demand being created, and this JTBT pivot actually now allows us, so it's changed the, you know, the TAM in that sense for us. We feel that everybody who's trying to celebrate an important occasion in their life or seeking a certain occasion is our customer, which means that now we are competing with people who are selling watches and clothes and, you know, even going on travel. And which is why we are now thinking that if I have to compete with a watch category, right? Not just with jewelry. So today, you know, if you want to buy a watch, you can go on Amazon and you will get it in 6 hours. So if you are a last minute person who's forgotten his wife's birthday, you can get it in 6 hours. So we say that we have an advantage on the product because jewelry has fundamentally got more emotion built into it. But we have a disadvantage because we cannot deliver in 6 hours. So let's build that piece. So we want to make sure that, you know, each category we compete with when we say we are in that space. So let's take away the advantages which they have. And obviously, let's keep building on the advantages we have. So if you just think about it like that, right, that the time itself has changed. So there's such a massive opportunity.
Not just looking at jewelry, but looking at gifting as the entire spectrum.
Not just gifting. I would say, in fact, now our mission is to say that we want to help customers express their emotions through jewelry. So the expression of emotions is for gifting as well as for self-gifting, right? Like today, you know, you have this successful podcast, and if you reach a certain number, you know, YouTube says you have the best podcast and you want to celebrate that. We want to be in your consideration when you think, how should I celebrate this? So obviously, we don't have a lot of products for men today, but we'll get there. But at least women who are, you know, equally doing so well in life.
That example really lasts. So yeah, no, experiences, gifting, expression of emotions. Wow, that's a that's a great way to look at TAM in itself. Very interesting. As we go deeper, right, like I'd love to understand that, you know, you're talking about like so 245 stores, around 2,100 crores in revenue. That's about 9 crores per store. If you have to break down, like, how does the store business in itself work, right? Because like you had that fascination for retail, I think a lot of customers who just get the end product today, who walk into a store and buy, don't really understand what happens on the back end, right? And as a company, you do this heavy lifting of deciding where to start a store, what to do there, having a team in place for that store, understanding what demographics are. So talk to us about this operational engine and also the science behind understanding where do you set up some of these stores. That'll be, I think, very, very interesting.
So I'll start with, you know, how we decide where to open stores. Sure. So, you know, it again goes down to the segmentation, right? We feel that, you know, our customers live to other people who can be our customers. Like we live, you know, close to people who are very similar to us. So which is why we look at everything in terms of pin codes and micro markets. That people who live in this pin code, if enough of them are buying, then we should keep investing in this pin code, right? So the way we identify where to open stores is based on all our online browsing and buying data, that we have enough demand, enough online conversion happening, so let's go and open a store. And we have a sense now that if you open a store, how much will the business multiply by? And how much will conversion multiply by? So you start with that. Then you say, okay, now that we have identified demand, what we need, we don't say we open a store, we say that we'll put the full omni-channel stack in place to serve these customers in these pin codes in the best possible way. Which means that it's not only opening a store, we have to make sure that the try at homes is available at that pin code. We have to make sure that 24-hour delivery, which I said, right, if you are going to compete with watches, is available in that pin code. We have, you know, now we have old gold machines, engraving machines everywhere, right? Because engraving is also a key part of providing that experience. That has to be available. We need to make sure that, you know, an FC and other inventory availability is totally sorted. People in place, right? Regional resources, training, merchandising, VM, marketing has to be in place. So, you know, and then we have this whole, you know, the way the marketing happens, right? There's a lot of handshake between different channels. And there are people who support that, right? We call these omni teams. So that has to be in place. So in a way, that's the omni-channel stack which has to be put in place in each of these pin codes or these micro markets which we serve. And then there's obviously then the next phase is that once we have to then make it work, right? Which means then the whole engine starts to work, that your marketing is now fully aligned to drive more traffic into the stores over there or through Try at Home. So you, the way you do marketing changes, the way you plan inventory, not just for the store in that catchment, but in general for the city and what you show customers, all of that changes accordingly. You also look at it that are there specific categories and specific type of customers who we want. So for example, if you, there are places like Powai, for example, where there's a lot of people who come because they want to gift something to a colleague for their farewell, birthday, whatever, and they need a different kind of product. So the merchandising mix then needs to fall in place. So there's a playbook basically, essentially, you know, the number of people we need, do we need a person, you know, we have this marketing executives inside the store also, you know, when people call or we have to call a customer, so they take care of that. So all of that is put in place, and then there's a playbook and one a gazillion metrics to look at, which are put into place to monitor that business very, very closely. And this is exactly what I'm saying. Now I think we have got a good handle on this, but it's still going to take a lot of work to make sure that this playbook gets executed each day in each of these 245 stores or these 245 micro markets. So that is essentially, you know, the way we do it. The other thing which we want to, which we are trying to do, is that, you know, there is a lot of complications and complexities in this business. At least our effort is that, you know, we can make, we want to make life complicated for ourselves, but try and keep it simple for the customer. Absolutely. Which is why internally sometimes it's a real complex, messy operation, because, you know, there are so many things which happen, but
so
we want to keep it
aligned for this to work, right, on the back end.
Yeah, there's a lot of things, and because, you know, of the unique nature of the category and the unique model which we have to do business, that there is major complexity. You know, sometimes people compare us to a fashion business or an electronics business and say, you know, in that business we can do this, but we can't do it, because they don't understand the, you know, there's so much complexity, like fraud and risk is so high in this category because of the nature of the product, right? You know, they say that why do CaratLane people who come for delivery not wear a CaratLane t-shirt? Because there is so much risk, right? We don't want that guy to get abducted, because everybody would know that he's carrying jewelry.
Yeah.
And we know that that has happened in some other brands as well. So simple things like that, right? The way you do returns, it's very easy for Myntra to say immediately processed, right? The moment it's picked up. If we don't check the jewelry, although we do it fairly quickly now and we have made some changes, but there are a lot of complexities because of the nature of the category. You know, very few people, all these, there are so many cool startups in logistics, right? You can check how many of them are willing to handle jewelry. Nobody wants to handle jewelry, right?
Yeah.
So the ecosystem is still very, very, I would say, is not as advanced as it would be for, if you want to start a fashion business today, everything would be available and you can start your business tomorrow. You can't do that for a jewelry business.
Yeah, that's lovely. I think it helps us appreciate the complexity that goes on behind and, you know, what the company does to bring the experience to life for a customer. Very, very fascinating. I'd mean just to also know how teams function here, right? Because is it like, I'm guessing it can't be a store-by-store team, right? Because that's just difficult to manage. But the marketing team, is it similar for, you know, online plus offline? Because there was a time where...
It was like that. Yeah. And for the longest time, the whole company was split into two parts. There was an online business and there was a store business. So marketing, sales, merchandising, analytics, all these business teams were separate. Now everything is integrated and nobody carries any goal saying that what is your online target, whether it is. So everybody has to do it for the business. In fact, when we look at something like conversion or revenue or growth or any such number, everything is at a business level only. In fact, if, which is why we don't see the business like that, when we don't give numbers like that, when we don't talk like that. So the way we divide the business is like the lowest common denominator. It is the denominator is the PIN code. And then we look at the catchment and we look at the city. But we don't say online and offline, because we have realized that these are not two channels. This is one integrated channel where some parts happen over here, some parts happen in the other channel. And they have to be very, very tightly integrated with each other to make that happen. So I think that took a lot of work, because it's not easy, right? Because you are making 2,000 people change the way they have been doing business. A lot of these people come from traditional retail backgrounds, right, where they have done things in a certain way. But today, if you go to a CaratLane store, he will tell you ki, how many active users are there in my catchment. You know, the language which the company uses has changed in that sense. I don't think you will go to any retail store. They will talk about footfalls. They won't tell you so many active users are browsing in my catchment, right? And if that number is low, then somebody will get in touch with the marketing team. So that's one big change that the entire organization has now been aligned to work as a business and not as, you know, working for two separate businesses. All their KRAs and metrics, etc., has changed. The other thing which we are trying to do is that, you know, we have, it still works in silos, right? That marketing and supply chain and sales and everybody. So we have changed the way these people work to try and make sure that everybody works towards the common business goal. And I'll give you one example. So we have a repair process, right? What would happen is that everybody involved in the repair process would do their job really well. So the store would send the jewelry on time. The logistics would say we have delivered it to the factory on time. They would say we have repaired it well, but the customers would be still very unhappy because everybody was, you know, focused on that functional goal. What we are now trying to do is that everybody needs to first prioritize the business goal. So all of these people have to make sure that the repair NPS is good. If the repair NPS is not good, then I don't care if you did your job on time. So that is one shift which has been going on for the last year and a half to move everybody to focus, you know, above a certain level, obviously, that you have to first deliver your business goal and you through whichever means possible, learn to work with the other teams and the other people who are involved in solving the same problem. And that is one, that's the other people element which we are kind of working on to bring in greater business accountability for everybody, which will lead to more collaboration, right?
Of course.
And greater accountability from each other as well.
Yeah, no, that's so true. I think that's a true manifestation of aligning incentives, as they say, right?
Yeah.
It sounds like a fancy phrase, but like that just puts it to action.
Because
that's when you have to work towards the business objective as opposed to your functional sort of objective. So, very interesting.
Because you touched on that, I want to give you two other examples.
Please do, please.
You know, there are times when a customer speaks to somebody, say, in the online sales team, you know, the call center which we have.
Right.
And then they go to a store and they, both teams or both individuals involved in this get full incentive for that order.
Wow.
It's not half and half because we realize that finally people are driven by their incentives, right?
Yeah.
They are not here to say that we want to build this great omni-channel business. That is what people sitting in this room think about.
Correct.
So that is why we have kind of made it very clear. And you know, if you think of it from the financial angle, you might say that, you know, it's wastage, we are paying two times the incentive, but you don't understand that how many problems it solves.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you can figure out the incentive to say, assuming that certain percentage of orders will be shared like this. But it's so important to give it because that person on the ground or in the who's handling the customer should not feel that I will lose out on anything.
The
so it's very
also multiplies, right? So net effect on the business is also very high.
Yeah, we have another program that, you know, if you have built a relationship with the customer,
mm-hmm.
and if that person comes and buys again this year, you know, if he had purchased from you last year,
right.
Whichever channel he buys from, whichever store he buys from, whichever salesperson he buys from this year, you will get credit for that and an incentive for that. Because we feel that the reason that person is coming back is because you built a great relationship and you gave a great experience. So, you know, in a way, it is to align incentives, not just with outcomes, but with the right behaviors.
Right.
So we want to make sure that you serve the customer well, whatever problem, you know, repair and all, who will care about it, right? There's no revenue credit. But how do we make sure that when the customer comes and says, my jewelry is broken and I want service,
mm-hmm.
you don't say, boss, why should I do it? So all of that has to be built into the incentivization.
Yeah, it has to be objective as well. And there's a way to do it.
Yeah.
It's really refreshing, I think, because otherwise this looks like, you know, a plain statement that is good on a wall, but does not get really acted upon. But I think that puts it into a lot of perspective. I'd be curious to know that if we took a step back, right, a lot of narrative around consumer brands in India currently is key. You can win them online, but scaling them offline and really reaching the masses in India is a very difficult challenge. Caratlean, of course, proves both these theses wrong and has proven and shown that it is possible to build a brand, large AOV, build trust, and scale offline and online, right? Really go omni-channel. What do you think is that, you know, brands when thinking about either going retail can do better? Is this a problem of visibility where people don't find you enough offline, which is why they can't buy? So is it an expansion problem? Is it an operations problem? What do you think is the broad narrative around brands really scaling well through this omni-channel approach? Other brands, other categories?
See, the thing is that most examples which I see, they are still operating, you feel as if two businesses. They have a retail business and they are, obviously if you open a lot of stores, you will get revenue, right?
Mm.
But if you think about stores, profitability, and like-to-like growth, one of the biggest challenges in a retail business, forget about, for one second, just forget about all the digital and online aspects.
Okay.
You can just build a retail business, right?
Yeah.
The biggest challenge in retail is to get customers, right? The second biggest challenge in retail is to plan inventory, because your inventory turns will kill your business, right? So how do you solve for the problem of efficient inventory and high footfall? Because both these things are then connected to the other thing, right? Which is that, is the store going to be profitable, and not just profitable this year, profitable year on year, you know, and whether you will get like-to-like growth. This is where digital comes in and plays a very big role, because the data which you have to open stores in the right place, right? Because otherwise, if you know, if 20% of your stores you open in the wrong location, the loss which will come from that will kill your business, right? If you don't know what people in this catchment are browsing, and therefore what you need to keep, like in our case, you know, we have 8,000 products in our catalog, 8,000 unique SKUs, and then there are variants for that, right? Different metal types, different sizes, etc., etc. A CaratLane store typically has 1,400 products. So you have to really know that what are those 1,400 designs which I'm going to keep in the store. How do you do that? You can't just do it based on sales, right? Then it becomes self-fulfilling. Ki aapne jo rakha wo bika, to aapko laga yehi rakhna chahiye, right? You have to guess that what should I keep? How do you do that? Again, it comes from data, right? Right. Third thing, just to drive like-to-like growth, you have to find ways to keep driving people to your stores, right? You can't say, let me open a store and I'll put out a newspaper ad and people will start coming. It doesn't happen. Business can't be. We are able to drive 90% of the business which happens in CaratLane stores. The person has started a journey online in the last 30 days.
Wow.
Yes. Which is why we have such high like-to-like growth, because the digital methods, the marketing and the merchandising and the website, is able to keep pushing people to the store. And the reason it also happens is because we are only targeting customers who are anyways living in that catchment.
Yeah.
And then you're just making sure that they like the design, they know the service, they discover the store, you connect them directly to the store. So if you go to our website, you know, there are many ways in which you can directly connect to your neighborhood store. You can directly do a WhatsApp, or you can directly ask for a product to be sent to that store, all of those things. And there is still a lot of work happening on that. We don't feel it is even 40% there in terms of how we would ideally want it. So there's a lot of work to be done over there. But essentially, the moment you think of how will you solve these fundamental retail problems, right? All retail businesses have had this problem. This is where, you know, these elements of the marketing or the consumer or the digital part or the data part comes into play.
Yeah.
If you have this clarity that, you know, like I said, you know, each piece has to play a certain role for the business. If you have that clarity, then it's great to expand, and it's a good way to expand the business, because offline definitely plays a big role in many categories. You know, a category like ours, where touch and feel is still very, very important. And, you know, there are other reasons why people go to the store which most people don't realize. So, you know, today if you just realize that you have to go and buy a product for somebody, you know, and if you have to go for a party today, basically, then there is no online delivery mechanism which can deliver the product to you in 4 hours. So you have to go to the store, and that's a very common use case, right? Second, see, it's also a very enjoyable thing. If you talk to a lot of women, you will notice that people like to go with their friend shopping, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, go and look at jewelry, try jewelry and buy jewelry. And that happens for a lot of other categories, right? They want to go to the salon together, right? It's an enjoyable thing. They want to go sari shopping together. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of, and men also do that, right? Men go want to see cars together, right? Or they want to go sports matches together, or they possibly want to go and buy shoes together.
Yeah.
It's a very enjoyable thing to, you know, enjoy trying on these things for a category which you love.
Yeah.
And which can only happen in a store. So the store plays a lot of other roles in the business, and it's not just to say touch and feel.
Yeah.
Once you start to understand these nuances of the business, you will know, you know, how the business should be scaled, what role the store has to play, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, no, I think that's super helpful, because, you know, anybody who's listening can use these frameworks to just understand if at all the category requires an omnichannel presence, and if it does, what are the nuances required to build a retail business in it. Was super, super interesting. Thank you so much for sharing. I think, you know, as we, you know, go towards some of the concluding aspects, the other very interesting thing about CaratLane is, of course, the trust. Considering the category is such, you need to really trust the brand. And that also, of course, comes with the strategic partnership, right? Congratulations on all the news. There's been a lot of chatter around how this is a success for the entire ecosystem, right?
Yeah.
When these things happen, especially in a market like this, everybody is just rejoicing the good news because rightly so. So the Tanishq partnership, the Titan partnership, right? Talk to us about how that plays a role in instilling trust. What have been your learnings in working with the Tata Group in general? That'll be very interesting to understand from both a consumer lens and also as a company. And personally for you, what that has done for the trajectory, I think that'll be super useful.
See, so I'll start with the trust part. Obviously, the association with Tanishq and Titan is such a big deal in terms of building trust, right? Because the Tatas, I think, are the most possibly the most reputed consumer brand in this country. So that obviously played a big, big role, having that association with them. The other ways in which we have tried to build trust, one is through our policies, right? That when you tell people that, you know, there's a return exchange, all of these policies, then they feel that, yes, it can happen. Opening of stores also helped because, you know, there was a time when we started this business, right? There used to be a term for internet businesses called fly-by-night operator, where people would worry
that would mean
that these guys would set up a website and they would take orders and then they would disappear. Because, you know, there was no physical thing to say ki where are these people sitting also, right? And is there an office also or not? In fact, in the early days, at least for some Chennai customers, we would call them to the office also to tell them that, you know, we exist. This is a place, right?
Yeah.
When you buy something from a store, aap ja ke lad sakte ho, right? If the product is not good or if the product is not delivered. And in a store, right, you pay and you take the product immediately. Yahan pe you pay and then you wait. So, obviously building stores also helped in a big way because people started to see the name, right? The other thing which helped is that, and we have focused a lot on this, is to make sure that people had a good experience, because when people tell others about their good experience, that also builds trust in a big way.
Absolutely.
So two things which have worked very well for us, one because of gifting. A lot of our new customers have been introduced to the brand because somebody gifted them CaratLane. That's played a very big role.
Yeah.
And obviously when people have bought and they have told others, right? Because this is something which you will see, right? And say, "Arey, where did you buy this?" And they will say, "Arey, I bought it from CaratLane." So that has, and we have done enough studies to understand the role of that. I would say that almost 20-30 people who have bought, new customers have bought because somebody told them about it. So you can understand the impact of referral or word of mouth.
20% of your
new customers comes from word of mouth in that sense. And this has been found time and time again in various surveys. In fact, you know, it's we don't have a way to track word of mouth, right? Because a lot of it happens offline, right, in conversations. But we have proxies for it to figure out whether, you know, and in a way it tells us whether the brand is now really becoming stronger because the word of mouth is really starting to happen now. You know, there's enough scale, enough happy customers. So that's the part about building trust. And we feel that going forward, see, we already have the Tanishq thing and we already have stores and we already have policies for building trust. But the single biggest lever to keep building it would be, again, to use word of mouth and to help our customers become our influencers in that sense. It's a hard thing, but we feel that that's the right thing to invest in. As far as the Titan people are considered, I think this doesn't get talked about enough, or I would say very little, that the relationship is very unique. Because, you know, and even now, even after they will acquire like almost 100%, they will acquire 100% of the equity, CaratLane will continue to be run as a separate independent legal entity, which means, you know, we are free to do things the way we have been doing, the way we run things, right? It's not going to be fitted into the, say, the Titan method in that sense, right? So that way, that gives us a lot of autonomy and freedom to try and do things in the way we feel is right for the customer or for the business. And at the same time, there is so much we get from them, right?
Yeah.
Starting with the trust from the Tanishq and Titan name, we have used and we have benefited from the large franchisee network which Titan has, from the know-how of retail, you know, how to open stores, how to get projects done, how to find locations, how to negotiate with people. We have benefited a lot on the manufacturing and supply chain side. We have benefited from the wisdom of the leadership over there, right? How to do things. And I think Bhaskar and Venkat and Subbu and all of these people have been super, super helpful in that sense forever. And, you know, the way we have thought about margins and profitability. You know, somebody needs to tell you how to build profit, right? And how to do it at scale. and it comes from experience. So that experience has come from them. So in that sense, there are many super useful ways in which we have benefited from this, and nobody will understand, you know, the value which comes from that, right?
Yeah.
Which I don't think any VC can bring in. I would really doubt, unless the VC has people who have also been involved in building a similar business, because it just comes from that know-how, right? In fact, we like to say that, you know, we have the, you know, it's a combination of the trust of Titan or Tanishq and the spirit of CaratLane, which works well for us. So we keep what is, you know, beautiful about us, and we also get what is, you know, special about Titan.
Absolutely. Well, the brand credibility, the knowledge transfer, the profitability, they've been a public entity, and, you know, just generations of, like, knowledge which has enabled them to be where they are. And I think that's just incredible to observe from and know that it's working out well, because from the outside it can look like, you know, it's a almost, it, you could say that there's a competing business as well, similar categories of sorts. Strategic partnerships are often looked not as well upon as well, because you could say you could have raised money otherwise as well and stuff like that. But then this working out really well for both sides is like cherry on top, and really good to know that it worked out well. Now, on the funding piece, you know, earlier also you mentioned, and, you know, this is, so 2016, the first partnership happened, which is the first stake, 62-64%, I think.
Yeah.
And then the full transaction happened. What was the, you know, thought process in your mind? Because traditionally, CaratLane, apart from, like, this round of news, has not been, you know, out there as much, right? You wouldn't hear of valuations. You wouldn't hear of, like, equity, all of that as much. But now, suddenly, of course, because of the acquisition, what was the thought? Was it always that we want to, like, be very inward-focused, profitability-focused, and not very inclined towards VCs, and that we'll do strategic? Or was it something that you discovered along the way?
So I'll tell you, when we started, there was never this intention, let's go raise money.
Right.
We ran this business for 4 years. Obviously, the business was launched in 2008. So in a sense, 3 years without raising any money. We reached a 1 crore net monthly revenue run rate without having raised a single rupee of revenue.
Well, so 2011 is 12. You're saying 1 crore per month. Net revenue.
Yeah. And only selling online, mind you. And this does not include the B2B business so much. This is all consumer revenue. You know, one of the things which I have personally learned from Mithun is what I call the Marwadi school of business, right? Which is the frugal way of doing business, right? To be very conscious of every rupee with the way you spend it, as if, you know, it was your own money. So that has been very, very deeply hardwired into us from the beginning, right? Because if the founder sets the tone, and then everybody follows, right, in that sense, because you know that he was also being very prudent about everything. So that was one. And we have never spent any money on any of the fancy things, which means if you go to our offices, this is actually the first nice office we have had. Some of the older offices, you know, some of our people would say that agencies don't want to come, itna, the approach is like this, or it's not a nice office and all of those things. And we are very thankful that people have not complained about it too much. So that is one. We have also never participated in, you know, and obviously then the investment happened from Tiger. Where we spent money on things, but it was not done in a wasteful way. You know, it's not that we said, okay, now let's open a nice office and we'll have a bar in the evening on Fridays. None of those activities, right? It was done to try and grow the business, but not for anything. So that frugal mindset has always been there. Because I think in Mithun's mind also, we these concepts of burn rate and how much money we are losing and valuation was never the thing. They were always to build a profitable business. Luckily for us, the Titan people coming in made that thinking even stronger, because for them also these concepts were very alien, right? That burn rate and we lose money and let's just grow at any cost. So that helped. So obviously these things are not, I would say, sexy enough for the media, right?
Yeah.
Because you're not doing, and we have never participated in any of these competitions, you know, the rewards and awards where you pay money and you get coverage. In fact, that's like at an organization policy, it is like a strict no-no. We also don't publish these case studies with, you know, the Google, Facebooks and the other agencies and other service providers of the world. Because we don't want people to know what we are doing, right? Because we think that we do things slightly differently. So we are not interested in just talking about it. And we also see no value. You know, if there was value from this PR, we would have done it. So I think that objectivity, right, that only do things which will benefit the business or the customer. So anything which doesn't benefit, right, a fancy office doesn't benefit, all these awards and all. Customers don't buy your product because you have got some award somewhere, right? Or you have been given this best place to work award by somebody or you have the best CEO award or anything, right? They buy if the product and the service has to be great. So in that sense, we have not done any of the things which gets the attention of the media. We also, you know, because after 2016, there has not been any valuation story, right?
Yeah.
If we had regular valuation stories, ki unicorn and ye itna billion, then exactly. Now that there is a story which has valued the company, you know, at 17,000 crores, now everybody is interested, right? So if we had a news like this every 2 years, I'm sure there would have been a lot of coverage.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that going forward, again, we will go back into our lair and the coverage will reduce, because I think these are things like right now we are on everybody's mind because of this.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there are things which people are discovering. But I think that the media is not interested in, you know, these stories. This is not sexy, I would say. You know, even the way we do business, like the question which you are asking, there are so many other things which we can talk about, which I can say with confidence are very unique to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the way we decide what jewelry to design, and there's a lot of other stuff.
Tell us a couple, if you don't mind, like if you had to point out like some of the most distinct things about the way Caratlane does business, what would they be?
See, this, we have, like I said, right, the way we think about store opening, for example,
yeah.
Or the way we think about the P&L and no online, offline PIN codes, all of those things, at least we didn't know that anybody else was doing that in that sense. The way we decide what jewelry to design, so there's a lot of data and pilots which happen before we do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
This whole company has become data-driven. So I told you, right, you can go to a store person, and he will tell you how many active users they have in the catchment. You can go to our design people, the people who design jewelry. And they will tell you about CTRs and conversion rates and the P&L for their subcategory. So that is the level of, you know, that is how people decide to do things. So I think that is very, very deeply ingrained. And we don't feel that, you know, just because you are in a more creative function, that you should not be looking at information or data and you should not be objective about things. So I don't know. I find it odd sometimes because, you know, when people have one-on-one conversations, they find a lot of this very interesting.
Yeah.
And people see value and people reach out for advice.
Yeah.
But I don't think the media or the... and because the media doesn't find it interesting, I think people also kind of follow the media, right? What
yeah.
they are, and they find that's more important or interesting to say.
Yeah.
So I think to at least post once in a while on LinkedIn. Mithun even doesn't do that. Now he started to do a little. So in that sense, I think we have just done what we thought would help the business and not focused on things which would not help the business. You know, even this whole omni-channel thing, it was not that we said that let's build an omni-channel business one day. We were always saying that let's do whatever which will either improve conversion or experience.
Yeah.
And so the reason we started to build stores because we saw that it was improving conversion in that catchment or that PIN code.
And the customers were there, so you're
yeah.
doing what's best for them.
Yeah. So if that was not happening, then we would have not done that. And even today, all decisions are made based on that, from that lens.
Yeah.
That will it either bring, improve experience or conversion or help growth without, you know, being wasteful in that sense.
Got it. Well, that's very refreshing to hear because, you know, one may imagine, at least from the outside, that a consumer business can benefit a lot from PR, can benefit a lot from, you
it
know,
does, it does, it does. But, you know, the right kind of PR, the right
yeah,
kind
exactly,
of stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you do it in your own way. You make the brand distinctly stand out in your own ways, and that is good. And you want to focus on what's really true. And it enforces why founders actually start companies, right? It's not for all of these fancy reasons which look fancy from the outside, but it's for all the reasons of benefiting the customer and generating value for them. So I love that.
In fact, because you asked, I'll tell you two other things which I think
sure.
most people don't do.
Please.
You go to a Caratlane store opening.
Mm-hmm.
You will never see a celebrity. We don't call film stars or politicians or, you know, other famous. We always call a loyal customer of the brand
wow.
to come and do the store opening, to do the inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
Even people from the company. So people, a partner or somebody will, you know, call Mithun or me or Atul or anybody. We don't go and cut the ribbon. It's always cut by the customer because we feel that the most important person who comes to the store is the customer. Similarly, we have never had a brand ambassador because we feel that the single most important thing which helps build the brand is the product. You know, we don't need a famous person to say that, you know, this jewelry is nice. I think the jewelry can say for itself that I am nice and you should wear it.
Yeah.
You know, because I think these are... The reason I say this is because I think you can only build a culture of, say, customer centricity or design centricity if all such actions are, you know, you literally walk the talk.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say we are customer centric and you say
it again.
Yeah.
That's super interesting. In fact, I was going through the social media and I was trying to distinctly, like, you know, identify ki, achha, ye person hoga, ye person hoga, is the brand ambassador. But I didn't find one, and I thought that was maybe a design
a miss from the social media team.
Yeah, no, but that's so cool. I think it's very important to just understand how important fundamentals are, right? And you've been talking about them time and again, and it really shows in action. This ought to be a case study once, I guess. Moving on, I think the other very, very fascinating aspect is you once quoted on another podcast that, you know, you don't hire from IIMs and IITs.
We stopped hiring them for doing this whole MT thing for many of our teams, essentially.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So broadly, I want to understand why that is. And then how do you then look at, you know, talent hiring and training more importantly, right? Because there's a different system that works. What is that system? And we've spoken about what that system is, but how does that work and how do you train them would be very interesting. So why don't you hire IIT IIMs for that function and what do you do instead?
See, the first thing was that it's not that we didn't hire in the past.
Mm.
And not just that, we would hire from other big name companies also earlier.
Sure.
We saw two problems. One is that it kind of became apparent to me that they would see this as a stepping stone to join one of the FANG or now the MANG companies, right? When your objective is to join those companies, you will only look at, you know, what will build your resume, which will make you attractive for that company. These people would always have a challenge, you know, that we are not building cool stuff, kuch AI, VR, AR, all of that, cool algorithms and these things. We would say, let's go to the store, let's talk to customers, or let's go meet customers, understand why they are not buying or why is the conversion not increasing. And this would sometimes, you know, be a hard thing. Or, you know, we would actually tell them that we should go sell in the store so that you understand how hard it is to sell, so that we can change the internal applications for our sales teams, for example. But we would see that it was always a bit of a problem because the focus was that this is not going to help. You know, if I tell in the Google interview, no offense to Google, obviously, that I only, you know, I've done this. And because sometimes we saw that the solutions which were needed didn't need a tech solution as such.
Right.
You know, sometimes some change in the configuration, change in the communication, change in the way you train people how to use it could also bring about the desired impact. You were not only focused and obsessed with making technology changes to do product management. So people didn't like that, obviously, and people were obviously also not, and there was a lot of attrition. You know, every year, there was a time when a lot of the marketplaces would seriously think about the jewelry category, and our people would go there, because they will say, now this year, we are going to build the jewelry vertical, or go to all of these other places. So we said that, boss, we need to change this. So let's now ignore the capability part. Let's just focus on the right fit in terms of wanting to be at Carrot Lane, you know, wanting to do this customer work, really enjoying that, getting satisfaction from the business impact they were creating, you know, willing to learn all of that. And we said we can teach. Yeah, product management is not so complicated, right? Even writing PRDs and all is overstated, right? How important it is. If you do a lot of consumer work, you'll find enough good problems to solve. So that's how we changed the way we started hiring people. And anyways, there was a compensation problem also, right? The salaries in these IIT IIMs and all of these places is going through the roof, right?
Yeah.
So we can't break our compensation structure also, right? So, and which is why, you know, we generally do only lateral hires, because people come and work for a particular role. We are not so big yet that we can have a big bench strength of people, right, who are not working for specific things.
Yeah.
And then what we started doing is that, one, we started changing the way we hired. So we hired, just a, you know, we have a girl who's actually a jewelry designer for a long time. Then she did a course from UpGrad and she's joined the product team. We have a lot of internal promotions from non-technical functions. So we have people who were working in the call center, for example, and now they have joined the product team and they do a great job.
Wow.
So it's a combination of looking at alternate talent pools, you know, not just people who are working in product management roles or coming from very, you know, these colleges are great, right? I come from one of them and there's no offense, but it doesn't fit what we want. And then a lot of internal thing, and the way we do the internal activity is that we give these people a project to work on to prove that they can get into this role. So it's not that, you know, we just say, okay, you just do an interview and you join. So they do a project for 6 months with a product manager. And if they do a good job and the product team also feels confident, then they move into the product team. So, and it seems to be working well. And we give them time to learn the product management aspects after that.
Yeah.
But they can immediately start doing, you know, because these people come from a lot of consumer-facing roles, for example. So they know that part really well. And that, I think, is a part which we don't value enough.
Mm-hmm.
that good product people don't just need to know how about PRDs and technology, right? They also need to know about customers. And we feel that the whatever we lose in terms of some of the smarts which an IIT IIM grad would bring, and some of the know-how which would come from having worked in some of these companies and knowing so much about technology, they more than cover for it in from the hustle which they have, from the customer love which they have, from the time they spend with customers, you know, and in fact, they're great salespeople also, many of them, you know, they have been involved in selling, and I think selling is another underrated skill. If you can't sell, I don't think you can be a great product manager. So I think that is what we have done, and you know, we kind of, every time we have a problem like this, right, we just try and break it down and say, ki ye kyun ho raha and how do we fix it? And this is what we thought ki was one way to change it. Touch wood, our attrition is now almost zero in this team, which was very high once upon a time. So it's, and we are trying to do similar activities and, you know, other parts. And actually, this is just that, like I said, right, that we keep focused on solving for conversion. We just had the attrition as a problem and we said, how do we fix this, right? And we wanted people to spend more time with consumers. Just like, you know, we said that we wanted design and creative people to become more data oriented because it would change their work. So wherever you see a problem like this, you just try and break it down and they say, okay, let's go about. And we wanted our store people also to, you know about that you are like the king of this catchment, right? So you should own the catchment, you should know who's browsing and why are people not buying, why are people, you know, not coming to the store. So in that sense, it follows that same formula of problem solving or problem finding, I would say. And right now also, you know, I mentioned the collaboration part. We want everybody to know what is the business problem they are working on and not just the functional problem. And to give people this opportunity to, you know, in fact, we have changed the KRA structure now for everybody, for the whole organization, that a lot of emphasis is now on collaboration and working with others. A lot of emphasis is there and weightages for problem finding, for example, and business impact and not just functional expertise. Because, you know, we had this classic situation ki everybody did the job well, but the patient still died, that kind of thing. So to change that, see, the people part is still going to be hard because there are still reasons why people leave. And the problem we face is that, you know, when you have a lot of people who just raise money, then they come after your people, right? Like they come after everything. So it is, and you know, a lot of young people, obviously it's a big thing, right? If you get a lot of money, so we still lose people. We have a lot of work to be done on our side, right? Which is why I said that the people operations is a big priority for us right now, to make sure that we do all the things right so that people continue to stay here. We reduce our attrition, we increase our engagement, and we keep hiring the right kind of person, you know, who wants to work in this company for what, for the reasons this, for the right reasons, you know, for the things this company stands for. And I think that if you hire right, in that sense, that itself solves all the problems, right? Because they want to be here. You know, for the longest time, we had not articulated a mission or a vision like this. We just said that we wanted to become a profitable company. For a lot of people, that was a great mission, right? Typically, that's not how people write their mission, vision statement, right? They change, right, things which are like world-changing, right, that we want to. So we just said we should become a, we should keep growing well and we should be profitable. And that was a mission or a goal, whatever, I don't know whether it can be called a mission, but it resonated with a lot of people and they were motivated by that goal. So I think if you clearly articulate your goals and you clearly articulate how you do things and why you do those things, then, and if people want to come for those reasons, then we'll be fine.
Yeah. Again, I think a very unique approach in the sense that, you know, there are other ways to attract great talent, hone them and then take it to the next level. But to figure out a different talent pool that you need curated to your company and then figure out what works best for them is something that is very unique and something that has been working, right? So I think that's great to hear. I think as we conclude, I have a bunch of other questions on culture, but, you know, for the paucity of time, I think we should be mindful because we want everybody to stick around. And this is an interesting segment as well. I have a similar set of questions that I ask mostly to each guest towards the end. And we conclude with this. These are more personal in nature that, you know, gives us a understanding of your sort of characteristic. But one is, you know, on asking for help, rather, not helplessness. But I remember you mentioned in one of the interviews that you become shameless in asking for help because that was the nature of what you had to do, right? It was just desperation of getting orders, everything, right? Talk to us about what that really means in the scope of entrepreneurship, right? Because a lot of founders talk about this, you know, just being very free in genuinely asking for help when you need it, be it for customers, orders, or just in personal, like just navigating the journey, right? What does that mean to you?
See, I think there are two things which help over there. One is shamelessness And the other thing is accepting your ignorance. So, you know, I mentioned at the beginning, right, that one of the reasons I possibly joined this company was because I didn't know what the risks were. And at the same time, for many of these things, right, many of the work which we have done, I think, and not just for me, I think for a lot of others also, that often we have had people in roles who have not had a lot of experience in that role, which, and they have accepted their ignorance and therefore been open to ask a lot of questions also. And sometimes because they ask these very fundamental questions, right, like, you know, sometimes ignorant people do, that it opened our mind to, you know, a more divergent way of thinking, that is this the only way to solve this problem or there are other ways to look at it.
Yeah.
And the shamelessness has also been there. You know, I think it just comes very naturally when you are in a situation like that, that customers don't want to buy a product, you can't find vendors who want to work with you, your customers don't want to buy. And so therefore you resort to whatever works, right, without breaking the law. And, you know, the customer obsession part, I think it helped. And it again came, you know, like whenever I would meet a woman, right, whether it was a PTA meeting or I would go to a doctor and you would see a woman wearing jewelry and you would say, why is this woman not wearing a carat-link jewelry, right? Because that's a question you want to understand, right, that we're spending so much on marketing and we're opening stores. So you don't hesitate in asking because you know that this is, you know, the way you see it, this is a great opportunity to really talk to a customer, right, rather than relying on some analytics data or some second or third hand information. So you just take that opportunity.
Exactly.
I think once you take that, you know, we are sometimes, we have too much baggage, you know, of ourself, the view which we create for the world, right, the way the world, we want the world to see us.
Yeah.
And so these are, that is what stops us from doing this. But the day you realize, right, that boss, this is an existential problem,
mm-hmm.
or what is there to lose, and we are anyways not going anywhere if we don't do it, right? And, you know, you don't think of yourself that I'm this big thing and I've started this company or whatever. And then you start asking these questions or you start chasing people like this.
Yeah.
And then I think the first few times you do it, after that you are totally...
It's just nature.
Yeah.
Do you have any funny stories from those times when, you know, you struck up a conversation in general public about, you know, either...
I think the funny
incident.
Thing is that, you know, it's almost as if my wife and kids or other people, right, they're just waiting for me to finish the conversation and they know that I'm not looking at the person but looking at her ears or the jewelry she's wearing, and they would just literally say that, you know, it's literally count that when will the question start and say, okay, by the way, have you heard about...
Nice.
Yeah.
That's very, very good. On a more, you know, general level, we talk about company values, we talk about company scaling, and that is very tangible in nature. Very often, we cannot quantify how people grow or what the values for people are. Do you have some, you know, core principles that you live by that, you know, you really, like your moral compass is defined by them? Or if you had to really, you know, tangibly define from, you know, the person that entered Carat-Link, you know, got joined as the first employee 2007 to 2011, then 2015 you joined back and now CEO. What has that sort of transformation been like, and what is your like core values like for you personally?
See, I think I mentioned, right, that I was very unhappy at my previous workplaces.
Yeah.
In this place, I think I have literally found nirvana in that sense, right? Like, I don't think I can imagine a workplace which can be better than this for anybody. Right, and it's gone on for such a long time.
Yeah.
And because you, in that sense, when I say nirvana, you've really found, I would say, true happiness and satisfaction and fulfillment, right, which is what all the philosophers talk about. So in that sense, you have attained, got that wisdom, right, that what really makes you happy, that nothing else matters.
Mm-hmm.
See, all this money and this valuation has happened recently, right? It's not that 4 years back we would think about it every day, that what is the valuation and whether we are going to make any money or not. And you were still very happy and super satisfied, and every day you would come with energy in the morning and you couldn't wait to come back to work, right? Which is like unreal, right? I never had that experience anywhere. So this whole process and the time which I spent through which I discovered this, you know, and by doing that, right, you have learned everything about yourself. You know, you have learned about things which really matter in this world. I'm not saying that I've got all the wisdom in the world, but because I have experienced, you know, this concept of flow and all the other things which I said, by experiencing it, you know, the journey through which you experience this, right, has taught you a lot about life and about yourself and what really matters and what doesn't matter, which is why, you know, while there is this big news and this money and everything has come in, but you know what is also making me unhappy is that, okay, it's, you know, Mithun is going to move on, right? Because I could have never asked for a better boss, for example, right? We have never, honestly, you know, the way our, we have never had a compensation discussion, we have never had a proper appraisal discussion. It's just based on trust. When I rejoined this company, there was no role for me. He just said, come, we'll figure out. I don't think anybody who has two children is moving from Delhi to Bombay would do that, right? Without having a clear role in life. You only do it when you have very high level of trust, right? So you have experienced trust with a non-family member of that level. Those are things which you otherwise don't get to see in life, right? Most people possibly go through life without having experienced that. So all of those experiences, you know, and the journey of having come to that point, right, of where you experience that, that teaches you so much. So I think that way is, you know, and all of it changes you, right? Because you come with a different worldview and then you go through all of this. So you start to value things differently. Your value system changes. The way you think about things changes. And, you know, how you prioritize things change. What you want to do in the future changes. So in that sense, I think I have to gone through like a, other than the physical part of myself and the hair which I have lost in this company, I think my soul and my mind has completely been transformed over here.
No, awesome. I think thank you so much for mentioning that, because as you were explaining, I think it just shows, right, for all the reasons that founders start and the growth, it just shows in your eyes that it's been such a fulfilling journey. I want to ask you a flip question to this, right? In a world where Caritlyn did not exist, what would you end up doing?
See, so the unhappiness was there. I think that sooner or later, I would have definitely gone, either started or joined a startup, something, because I would, I don't think I would, in retail or something else. See, I would have definitely, see, it just happened that this opportunity was in retail. But if there was an opportunity in some other interesting kind of business, I would say, and if it was a young business in that sense or a new business in that sense, then that would have definitely excited me. So I think that, I at least that part, I'm very sure that sooner or later I would have ended up in a startup for sure, because, you know, I got into a startup when these things were not so common. As they would have become more common and you would have heard of more stories of people who are more satisfied and more fulfilled in their work, you would have started reaching out to people and said, okay, let me go join something.
So
I don't know whether it would have been
similar.
So successful, it would have possibly not worked out. I would have gone to another startup. So I think that way is, I think that I can be reasonably sure of, that I would have ended up in a startup.
And in a world where startups did not exist, is there a life sort of hobby that you would have liked to follow as a profession?
So I was very, very keen to get into a sports-related business.
Okay.
In fact, I wrote a post about it also once, that I was, because I was so passionate about sports. I'm not a great player, by the way, but I'm very interested in multiple sports, and I used to follow, write, read, research, like religiously almost.
Oh, wow.
So, and I would think that this is my passion, so I should find work in my passion, right? Find a way to work in your area of passion.
Right.
And I spoke to a lot of people. I tried to do things, which is why I was doing that blogging thing also, to see if I could get into that area. It didn't happen eventually. And eventually, you know, what I realized is that I found passion in my work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it came from the other direction, that you started doing this Caritlyn thing, which was work. And because you finally discovered so many things about yourself, right? Things which you didn't know about yourself, that this would also give you so much joy.
Yeah.
And because of that discovery, you realize ki, you know, you found passion in something else which you didn't know earlier existed. And in a way, that also answers your previous question, right? That instead of finding work in your passion, you found passion in your work. And that actually got the best of both worlds for you, right?
Yeah.
I think, you know, I don't know, because I also come from a analytics background, possibly I could have gone into that area.
Yeah.
I actually worked in the Times business, you know, the internet business of Times for 4 years, where I also was building new businesses over there. In fact, I started this thing called Code Gladiators, which has become very big right now. So, which was in the, you know, a hiring space.
Yeah.
So even if it was not jewelry, I think some other consumer space or would have eventually starting a new business, actually, you know, and the way, because the whole culture in a situation like that and the way things work, I obviously have a bias for action. And it is good to work around people like that because you draw energy from them. So all of those things really help. So I think I would have ended up in a situation like that for sure.
Got it. The reason we ask this question is, I think it's just sometimes very exciting to think of an alternative reality. It pushes you to think beyond the general, because otherwise, you know, day to day can really catch up. So I think that's good. But I think it's very distinct to mention that it's important to find passion where you work as well, right? That really makes the job fulfilling. Otherwise, we can live our lives paycheck to paycheck and like from month to month for that next promotion, and it doesn't lead to anything. So I think it's very important and very applicable for a lot of people. So I think that's profound.
Actually, I just want to add one more thing to that.
Please.
Because I discovered this later, because there was a person called Eric Fromm who wrote about East Germany and West Germany, that there are two types of freedom. You know, one is the freedom that you can do whatever you want, right? Which is what you get in a startup, that you can do work in the way you want to do, right? That is your work itself, right? That your work itself allows you all the freedom and the passion and everything. The other is that what he calls freedom from, what he means by that is, you know, that if everything else is taken care of, then also you have the freedom to not worry about those things and to do what you want. So the other alternate reality to that is that if I was one of these companies, right, which was a regular 9-to-5 situation, right, where you had enough free time on your hands and all your other needs were taken care of, then I think the alternate reality is that I would have definitely used the time to do something else, which would have given enough satisfaction in that sense. So it would not have been work, passion in your work, but passion in the free time which you got from work. And that was how the blogging thing was happening then, right? Because there was so much time that I would, you know, do all this writing and talking to people, and we did a few podcasts and all of those things. And I know somebody who was working with, who also was doing that thing. He finally got into that full time. I don't know whether that would have happened for me, but I think a lot of time, you know, and a lot of people do this, right? That they have a day job, but they have an alternate, and it, with the gig economy, it's become even more possible to pursue those things more actively. So I think if not startups, then that's the other alternate reality, I think.
I'm exhibit A when it comes to that entire principle, so... Yes, but no, glad you mentioned it, and it helps to reiterate, right? Because a lot of people in their own jobs may think sometimes that the job is very unidimensional, right? It's just like specific to one thing. But then these things reinforce that it's possible to find, like, you know, life's work in your jobs as well, or beyond it, because you have the luxury of time beyond the job. So yeah, super helpful. I think ending, right? And I was thinking, I always try to figure what's a very fitting end. And I think one of the things that I really distinctly, through my research also figured, and what you mentioned also stands out, is how much you've loved working at Garrett Lane, right? It just shows. And the ride, by no means, I'm sure, has been smooth, right? It's been a bumpy one. There must have been doubts along the way. For you personally, also in the company, you've had like a brief break. Talk to us about what really drives you to, you know, take up this founder journey, the CEO journey, and be in a company for this long period of time and see it through. And even with all the chatter around, right, like you want to continue, you are equally motivated, maybe more, right? Talk to us about this energy that you derive from entrepreneurship and what really motivates you to embark upon this reasonably challenging journey. I think that'll be a great end.
See, there is this theory of, you know, what is the human... fundamental human need, right, which keeps people happy. So they say there are three things. There is autonomy, mastery, and purpose. That if these are the things which really make people go, right? And if you think about it, I have managed to get all of these three things in this place. So the purpose, whether it is, it comes from the impact which you make, you build a big business, you change the way, you know, the world works in the sense that people buy jewelry, you create a different kind of a business model. The mastery also, that while you started as an ignorant person, but you have learned enough things on the way, and you have done things differently, which really matters to me. That, you know, are you doing things in your own way, or you're just copying everybody else? I think that has been very, very important for me. And when you see enough of those things working, it really makes you happy, right? And the autonomy piece, right, also comes from the fact that we have had the good fortune, not only as Garrett Lane, to make our decisions independently, but within Garrett Lane also, thanks to having worked with Mithun, that you have this the freedom and the luxury to keep doing things in your own way. And I think we are also very lucky that the people we have in this company, right, a lot of equally energetic and motivated people, that, you know, we feed off each other.
Yeah.
And I think as long as we have people like that also, I think that it'll come from them. The other things I would say is that I think, I don't know whether I am, is there a thing like naturally curious, but I think I am definitely over-indexed on curiosity. And a place like this, right, where there you deal with customers and there is a pipeline of problems because of the way we operate, you always have a long list of things which you think it has to be done.
Yeah.
I think as long as that list is there, your energy or your motivation will never dry up, because you will say, boss, this is, you know, things which have to be done. We haven't solved for those problems yet. I think the day you reach a stage, right, where this energy of the people is not there and you only have people who come here to, you know, do a job, and you don't have new problems to solve, you feel everything is done. That is the day I think it'll be the day to call it quits.
Right. But till then it continues.
Yeah, till then it'll, because you know, you're getting all of it, right? Mastery, yeah. Purpose and autonomy.
Yeah, I love that. I think that framework really puts it into perspective and goes to show how entrepreneurs embark upon this journey and successfully pursue it. So that's lovely. Great, I think. Thank you so much for being on the show. This has been such a pleasure. I have myself learned and taken back so much because, you know, I was trying to do so much research before the show and try to cover all my basics. But I think we've covered very interesting aspects of the business, your personal thought process, and also the overall trajectory of Carrot Lane. This is definitely one of the successes in the ecosystem, which gives all others watching a lot of hope, ambition, and this excitement about the future. Thank you for doing what you do, and thank you for being on the show. This has been
a
pleasure.
Thank you so much, and lovely talking to you, Jeevaraj, and thank you for, you know, talking about things which a lot of times people don't talk about. Lovely talking to you.
Thank you so much.